Welcome to China Money Podcast. I'm Nina Xiang in Beijing. To get ahead in the Chinese market, listen to China Money Podcast. Go to ChinaMoneyPodcast.com to find out more information. It's a good day in Beijing today, really sunny, and we're really happy to have our guest today, Mr. He Weiwen, co-director at the Study Center for China-US-EU Economy and Strategy, and also an adjunct professor teaching at Southwestern University of Finance and Economics. Welcome, Mr. He.
Thank you.
You also served as economic and commercial counselor at the Chinese Consulate General in San Francisco and in New York, altogether for 6 years?
Yes.
Leading up to 2003?
Yes, from 1997 to 2003.
You probably have a very good vantage point being in that position during that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's another decade now. We're 2011. What would you say is the biggest change between the interaction between Chinese companies and U.S. companies that you observe today?
I think there have been tremendous changes on China's side, that we were relatively small 10 years ago. Now we are strong. For instance, now the Fortune just published the Global 500 for 2011, and we have 61 companies on the Global 500 list. 10 years ago, we had only about 10, or even under 10. Now we are much stronger. And on the U.S. side, I think the American economy has experienced very difficult times over the past 10 years. First, the recession in 2001, and the most recently, the global financial crisis, and the most severe recession ever since the Great Depression in the last 80 years.
Thank you for that. And we have a lot to cover today. Biggest news,
yes,
I guess, is the interest rate hike by the People's Bank of China.
Yes.
It raised its benchmark deposit and lending rates by 25 basis points, effective on July the 7th,
yes,
Thursday, or that was yesterday. So this is the fifth rate hike since last October in China.
Mm-hmm.
And bank's reserve ratio has been raised 12 times already.
21.5%.
Right, yeah, uh-huh, since last January. So right now it's at a record high of 21.5%. So the question now is,
yes,
do you think this is the end of this cycle of monetary policy tightening?
We cannot say that's the end. However, on the other hand, we cannot say we were set to continue the interest rate hike, because it will depend on the development of the situation, especially the inflation situation. If the inflation momentum does come down in the latter half of this year, it might be temporary halt in the interest rate hikes. If the inflation rate is still high, then I'm sure that the Central Bank of China will consider further hikes in interest rates.
What is your view on the outlook for inflation for the second half of this year?
I think that the June figure should be above 6%. That might be the peak. I cannot say that July figure should be lower. It might be still very high. But that is about the top for this cycle. And we'll see a gradual coming down in the latter half, August or September. I'm sure it will be lower in the last quarter of this year. If we trace the move of interest rates and the moves of CPI index, then we cannot find any correlation. In the year 2007, there were 6 interest rate hikes. Then in the following year, 2008, CPI hit 5.9%. Okay, then the central bank didn't have any interest rate changes during the year, during the latter year of 2008 and the whole year of 2009, and the most part of 2010. Then we see in the year 2009, the CPI came down abruptly to minus 0.7%. And the second important factor we cannot neglect is the capital investment. If we still keep a high tempo of capital investment, inflation cannot come down. First five months of this year, capital investment still grew by 25.8% over a year ago. In the month of May, it's even accelerated by 0.4 percentage points. We must bring down investment.
Well, with monetary policy so tight, with banks' reserve ratio so high and also interest rate keep rising, where are the capital investment coming from?
I doubt that, because local government could borrow. That's some problem. That the big products, especially the government products, can always get some preferred treatment. Bank. And also, they are not only obtaining money from banks, they get money from the capital markets. They can raise issues like local government bonds, and so on and so forth. For instance, in the railway industry, they can issue railway construction bonds. That's another source.
Well, they can issue that in Hong Kong as well, and there is a huge demand for that.
Yeah, sure. And on the condition that, for instance, the subway system construction in many cities, in leading cities of China, they can work with Hong Kong. And they say that after we build that subway, we'll invite Hong Kong Subway Corporation to operate. That's what they've been doing in Beijing and Shenzhen.
Well, going back to the interest rate hike, I guess one of the danger for tightening the monetary supply too aggressively is it might lead to a hard landing. Are you worried about the hard landing?
Not that much, because the real growth engine in China lies in the local governments. They have different resources to accomplish that. For instance, we say that the national 12th five-year plans set the goal of 7% GDP growth for the next 5 years. Then we have a look at each of the provinces' 12 five-year plan. Not a single province had a goal less under 8%. So if all the provinces had a goal of over 8%, how could the whole country hit the 7%? Impossible. And the provinces are competing with each other. And the municipalities, cities are competing with each other. They are ranking themselves. That will keep the tempo quite strong.
Well, I mean, that leads to a fundamental problem for Chinese GDP, because the local government can say, we are targeting 8% GDP growth this year, and maybe 100% chances that they are going to achieve 8% growth. And the quality of the growth, though, is probably require a little bit, the benefit of doubt.
Yes, for instance, we say that many of our cities, over 600 cities, as between, that's the level between the province and the counties. Over the 600 or more the kind of cities, 80% of them have set a goal of building their cities into the great international cities, international metropolis. And the city of Lanzhou said they have to build another Lanzhou. The city of Guizhou said they will build another. Or Guiyang said we have built another Guiyang. And they want to rebuild a new city. Tremendous growth.
This doesn't sound like economic, market-driven economic development. Rather, it sounds like a political movement. We can compare this to the Great Leap Forward.
Of course, that's better than Great Leap Forward. Still, it's quite amazing. You see, we have a saying that Rome was not built in a single day. However, the local cities want to build Rome in a few years or in a decade, because they have only limited term. So their term, each term lasts four or five years. And usually the mayor can have one term or at least for two terms. They want to fundamentally change the image of the city. So they must do something. They lose no time. That's a big problem. I think the important thing for the local governments is to build more housing for the average people, to build more hospitals, to provide more benefits to people. Instead of to build some huge, magnificent buildings or squares or commercial real estate, that's not that important.
Well, so it sounds like, Professor He, you're not very concerned about the Chinese economy heading for a hard landing. The local government growth are going to be achieved as the politicians have promised. The Chinese economy will achieve its goal of 7% annual growth rate.
Above that, my personal figure is for the next 5 years would be above 8%. of course, less than, under 10%, maybe between 8 to 9%.
Okay. I guess you're less certain about the inflation outlook rather than the economic outlook. And you think the central bank probably further tighten the monetary supply if the inflation does not go down during the second half of this year?
It seems that the central bank is quite careful about further austerity. There has been some saying, we have to pay attention to that. Some changes in the wording by Premier Wen Jiabao. The important thing is to keep it constant, stable, not too many changes. Some people understand it's a signal saying that we will not have that much austerities in the months ahead. However, it's still too early to have the final judgment. And the one thing is for sure that the liquidity in China is still in an excessive state. For this M2 supply, the growth rate year on year is still about 15%. And by the end of December, I haven't checked the latest figure. By the end of December last year, it was the total outstanding was over 70 trillion yuan, or 170% of total GDP. In the case of America, by the month of May this year, the total M2 supply was $9,000 billion, or 60% of GDP, much, much lower than in China. People used to say that U.S. QE2 will create a lot of excessive liquidity, create inflation. However, if we come to say China, we see our own problems. So excessive liquidity is still a problem.
That's a very good point about excess liquidity, because that partially shows the ineffectiveness of central banks' monetary policies. Liquidity-wise,
yes,
it has limited power. Let's move on to the next topic about Chinese banks. We heard this week on Wednesday that Singapore's state investment firm Temasek Holdings sold half of its Bank of China stake for $2.42 billion, and also sold 8% of its holdings in China Construction Bank for $1.2 billion. Mm. So the market has basically took this news as a signal that Temasek is getting out of Chinese banks before the Chinese bank shares become problematic related to local government debt issues.
In a sense, I don't think that will be a serious issue.
Why?
Okay, let's come back to Temasek. There are three different issues at this point. First, Temasek quitting partially the holding China Construction Bank and the Bank of China. They are doing so more or less for their own investment portfolio restructures. Singapore has been moving forward with many new projects in China. For instance, ecology projects in Tianjin, Chengdu, Nanjing, as many. The second point is the China's banking system is still healthy. I think as far as Bank of China and the China Construction Banks are concerned, they are running on a quite comfortable situation. They are enjoying very profitable operations, at least up to 2010.
Right, they're going to probably make more money. Net interest margin,
yes,
is going to be even higher.
Fortune Global 500 just published on July the 7th. We see that China Construction Bank made a profit of almost $20 billion out of total revenue of $67 billion. Or the profit rate is 30%. And the Bank of China, 26%. $15.4 billion profit out of a total revenue of $59 billion. Let's compare with other leading world banks. The largest commercial bank in the world, ranking by Fortune 500, this Bank of America, is running a loss. And the second largest is the Banque Nationale de Paris of France. They had a profit rate of 8%. And the J.P. Morgan, the third largest, 15%. And the third point is local government debt. Now there's a serious problem. 10.7 trillion yuan total accumulated debt in the local government. If we compare with the real debt, it's about 6.7 that the local governments have to pay back. The rest being guaranteed by the local governments, it's not direct debt. 6.7 trillion yuan is about 52% of the local government's financial capabilities, resources. So they're still within the safe line, 100% internationally. However, the problem is growing. We have to pay enough attention to that.
There are people who agree with you, but however, the major rating agencies, Moody's, for example, had a report saying that non-performing loans in the Chinese banking system could hit 8 to 12% from the current 1.1%. You know, some people worry about that the Chinese government might have to get in for a state rescue or bailout.
Oh, yes. As they did 10 years ago.
So you feel like they're going to do this again this time?
Yes. First, I don't quite agree. The massive lending, too much mad lending, and too much construction, so as to slow down bank lending, slow down the local government infrastructure investment. And by slowing down investment, we can slow down the growth of GDP for more healthy, sustainable growth over the years. Of course, there's a big danger of increasing the non-performing loan ratio. That case happens, and I'm sure that will happen. I think the government had good experience in the late 1990s. Different options first, which are pick out non-performing loans.
And separate them into asset management firms.
Asset management firms. So the banks remain good. And then banks transfer out of debt into their stocks in the companies. Or maybe in today's case, they may change some of their claims to the stocks in the local government, the projects, so as to curtail the non-performing loan rate. Important things I think we should commit into mind. They are state-owned banks. The reputation is the central government. It's the country. So that's that strong, strong sovereign support.
Well, it's interesting because your view on this issue is similar to our last guest. The key question is really, you know, how big the problem will be and how much money is it going to cost the Chinese government. But I guess both of you agree that there isn't any systematic risk within the Chinese banking system relating to the local government debt issue.
So far. We can only say so far.
No, so far now.
So far not yet.
Okay.
We cannot say it will not definitely forever, no.
I want to share with you one of my favorite analysts covering Chinese banks. An analyst at Stanford Bernstein, Mike Werner, had a report this week about the same issue. I think there's two interesting things that he raised in his report. One is that China's listed banks will be able to absorb local government-related losses with minimal capital impact. So the banks would need to raise just $15 billion. So $15 billion. Just as a reference point, last year the Chinese listed banks raised $35 billion. So $15 billion is a piece
That's
of cake.
Okay.
Number two, Mike Werner pointed out that the worst of the local government exposures are in the central and western regions. That basically means those loans under the China's 12th five-year plan, they're going to be the priority of the central government to develop the central and western regions. They are largely held by the policy banks and smaller regional banks. The central government is going to make sure that those projects continue. I think you do have some support out there.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the next topic, very much relating to your background of China-U.S. Bilateral economic relations. A delegation from the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board will meet in Beijing next week with senior leadership of China's Finance Ministry and China's Securities Regulatory Commission. The two parties will start talks to potentially allow the U.S. to inspect auditing firms based in China. This obviously happened because of recent negative headlines relating to Chinese companies listed overseas. Are you optimistic that this talk is going to yield any positive outcome for investors?
Personally, I think it's necessary. Yes, we do see a lot of problems, failures, and even frauds from many Chinese companies listed in the U.S.
Well, you know, what I wonder about this is, why are they targeting only the auditing firms? What about the accounting firms? What about the hedge funds who financed the reverse mergers and brought those companies overseas in New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ or Toronto Stock Exchange? I think they should go all angles.
Oh, yes, I quite agree with you. Auditing is a key link in all the preparations. We picked up the auditing, I think, that's necessary. However, that's not
hopefully that's
all
only
story.
The beginning.
That's
right?
Not all the story. Mm-hmm. And one more thing, I think the American SEC and PCAOB should pay enough attention. They should have a better pre-examination of the companies who are going to get list in the U.S. because that's their regulation. That's their governance. They should have a better examination of the shell companies. I had personal experience. during my service in New York at the consulate, once I was invited to an event commemorating a public listing from the Heilongjiang company. They were just about reverse acquired by a shell company in New York.
Well, that was when?
2002. And at that time, I got the invitation, but I was reluctant to go, saying that I wanted to find out whether they got enough approval. So I was quite alert. So I sent my assistant to go there to understand the situation. And nearly one year later, we got information that there was a failure in the listing. And the Heilongjiang company lost the money. However, this middleman got money. They just divided the middleman, the fee among themselves and a bunch of people. That's really a big lesson. So we should be extremely careful in the reverse acquisition by shell companies.
Well, it seems like on the U.S. side, they should also strengthen their regulatory...
Of course, because the shell company was registered in the U.S., must undergo clear, strict supervision and governance by the U.S. authorities.
So this issue has been in existence for a long time, and I guess until recently it became really a focal point, and the government seems to be paying much more attention to this. Hopefully this is only the beginning to the U.S., both the U.S. and Chinese
yes.
sides, to strengthen
yes.
their own oversight so that investors can avoid
mm-hmm.
such losses in the
yeah,
future.
Yeah.
Now is the time to take a break, and we will play a game.
Oh, good.
mm-hmm. We'll play this game called Long Short. It's a game we adopted from the Financial Times. So basically, I'll give you a list of things, and then you say if you're long on that thing or you're short on
interesting.
It.
Interesting.
The time frame of your view should be short to medium term. So we're not looking at long term here. We're talking about short to medium term. Okay, so let's start. Pork prices.
Short.
The euro.
Short.
The US dollar.
Long.
The RMB.
Long.
Chinese property markets.
Flat.
Okay, new joy, I guess.
No. Short.
Okay, China's export industry.
Long.
Oil prices.
Short.
US economy.
Long.
Former IMF chief Dominic Strauss-Kahn.
Long.
You're longing? Why?
He will be announced innocent on July the 18th. Then he will be successful again in the lawsuit by a female correspondent in France back home. Then he will play an important role in next year's presidential election in France.
Well, what's your basis for that prediction?
Because Dominic Strauss-Kahn really did little in New York.
So you think there's a conspiracy?
Not necessarily conspiracy. However, America disliked it, so he must go.
That's great. Thank you for your insight.
You're welcome.
Welcome back. We have still more to discuss. First, we're going to turn to a trade dispute between China and the EU and the US. The World Trade Organization said on Tuesday that China's restrictions on exports of industrial raw materials violated international trade rules. So the European Union, the US, and Mexico previously filed a complaint against China in 2009, and this is the WTO's decision. Professor He, what does this mean for China's raw material industry, and that's the bigger issue of China's trade policies?
I think this is, first of all, I should say this, that is not a final official ruling by WTO. It's only the opinion, conclusion by expert panel. And the conclusion does not simply say that no, they support some of the measures adopted by the Chinese government. However, they disagree that China an export quota on those 9 raw materials. And they said China failed to follow WTO accession protocol and also violated the GATT 1994 net relevant clauses. I fully understand that Chinese government will go further to go to the appellate body to continue the case, will not accept the panel conclusion. For instance, we say that, yes, in our protocol, in the accession to WTO, we did say that we should not impose export quota nor export duty to our exports. However, in our protocol chapter 11, we have an appendix, some exemptions. We should study the appendix and say what situations could justify such application.
So the special, I guess, exemption is for environmental protection, right?
That's one thing. And also an important thing is we have to say that. We have to change. Environmental issues, we could have some exemption. However, we have to justify that with the sound reasons, with sufficient proofs.
If we do appeal the decision, how likely do you think WTO is going to change its decision?
I think the challenge is half to half.
And say WTO make a final decision that China does violate international trade rules, what would China do next?
China will change the policy. We will follow the WTO rules. We will honor the WTO rules. That's what we have been doing.
And what would the timeline be?
The Atlantic border usually works for 2 months. And of course, there are several months for our appeal. It's altogether, it won't take more than 1 year. You see, the real practice normally is longer than the regulations. According to WTO regulations, the panel examination and the conclusion usually lasts for 9 months. However, in this case, it lasted for over a year. So I guess there would have some extensions in the timeline. However, it will not be that long.
Right.
Within a year.
This is important because this could be a precedent for the next important issue, which is rare earth.
Yes.
Which China had a great dispute with the EU and also the US. People are predicting that the EU and the US are going to file a similar complaint with the WTO.
Oh, sure.
On that issue. Do you expect a similar decision from the WTO?
I don't think so, because first of all, it's too early to analyze the situation. And the important thing is the raw materials, the metals, are different from the rare earth. They are governed by different GATT rules. For instance, export duty for ordinary exports is governed by GATT Clause 8. And export quota for ordinary products is governed by GATT Clause 11. And the rare earth, not all rare earth, this kind, that's exhausting natural resources and environment sources, are governed by GATT Clause 10. So they are different stories. And the rare earth case, in this case, GATT Clause 10, general exemption applies. They said, in the case when a country or a territory wants to protect exhaust resources, natural resources, they could impose restrictions in export. However, there's a precondition. The country or territory must do the same in domestic consumption. They should not restrict exports. However, no restrictions on domestic.
And if that China is what works, China is doing.
Yes, if China works that way, China will certainly fail. However, we are stepping up control domestically. In the past, there was really a case that many local, small counties and villages even do that at a low cost. That's wrong. We are changing that. We should have strict, same controls, both to world market and to Chinese domestic.
And do you think the Chinese government will do that?
Yes, there should be no discrimination. Otherwise, we will be against WTO basic rule.
So what you're saying basically is China right now is doing things that's against WTO rules.
We cannot say that we are against WTO rules. We are working in this direction. That's we are controlling export and controlling domestic, but not so sufficient in domestic control because we lack experience and we have problems in the past. We had problems in the past. So we have to improve that to change that. That's the needs, efforts, needs
but we are only limiting exports while doing nothing to limit domestic consumption.
Actually, we have been doing something. Of course, not sufficient in controlling domestic consumption. Not enough. Their accusation is not totally true. We have been working in this direction. The challenges, again, the local governments want to step up the exploration and use of the rare earth. That's a big issue to tackle.
So let me ask you a question that is related, but it's a simple question. Why did China last summer suddenly decide to cut rare earth export by over half?
I think at a point, we have to take drastic measures if we want to change the trend. Otherwise, we cannot sustain. Of course, there are arguments whether this step is too drastic. on the whole, that control the export is necessary, and control of domestic consumption is also necessary in order to save rare earths.
Let's move on to the next news. This Tuesday, China's State Oceanic Administration announced that an oil leak did take place in China's Bohai Harbor at an offshore oil and gas well jointly developed by China's National Offshore Oil Corporation and ConocoPhillips China. First, let's talk about the manner of disclosure. This conference took place a month after the oil leak. What do you think went wrong?
I think that's totally wrong. They should do that immediately after the event happened. At most, a few days after the oil leak happened on June the 4th. And ConocoPhillips reported to China's Oceanic Administration right on the same day.
Do you think the company should take greater responsibility for not disclosing it, or the state Oceanic Administration?
I think most of the state Oceanic Administration to be held responsible, because the company did report. The administration just covered it. I watched a TV program yesterday. The spokesman from the administration said, because we had not found out enough information, that the general situation was still under investigation. That's not the reason. You didn't have the ability to cover that, because it's not in your room. It's in open sea, and it's not a small place. 840 square kilometers. So the whole 840 square kilometers water quality deteriorated to bad form.
This incident again shows how the Chinese government should really improve their disclosure practice in natural environmental disasters like this. I think their disclosure measure is really the second disaster in this oil leak. That's all for today's news. Thank you for listening. Again, go to ChinaMoneyPodcast.com to find out more information and also to leave a comment. And we'll see you next week.